The way we read is changing. Time we once might have spent curled up with a good book is now often devoted to catching up on blogs and browsing websites. To win readers back, one publisher has a new take on an old-fashioned idea. She's offering a serial novel, just as Charles Dickens used to do. But this one is on the web. She's calling it a wovel. It appears one chapter at a time, and readers have a say in how the plot advances. For member station KUSP, Rick Kleffel reports.
While she was working as an editor at Dark Horse Comics, Victoria Blake used breaks from work to surf the web.
I noticed that I was using my random 10 minutes in between tasks to go to Gawker.com, which is my favorite media gossip site. And I realized that if I provided prose fiction that I would want to read myself online, that I would use those 10 minutes to read prose, not gossip.
Blake left Dark Horse to found Underland Press, an integrated online and traditional print publisher. She wanted to offer exciting, edgy fiction with a touch of the fantastic and to make her website a primary component of her business. She hired Jesse Pollock to help her with web programming and then got together with him, some of his programming friends, a six-pack, and a bag of Oreos. They came up with a genre that demanded a new name, the wovel.
A wovel is a web novel. There's an installment every Monday. At the end of every installment, there's a binary plot branch point with a vote button at the end. Voting is open from Monday to Thursday.
For web programmer Jesse Pollock, the wovel format was reminiscent of the old choose-your-own-adventure books with a high-tech twist.
And that's what was so attractive about the thought of the wovel is allowing the readers to choose their way through and decide on integral changes in the plot.
The results go to the author, who writes from Thursday through Sunday. A new installment is posted on Sunday night and is ready for reading on Monday morning.
Victoria Blake understands this fast-paced format is a challenge for the wovelists. Jamia Jefferson is an author whose books include Wounds, Fiend, A Drop of Scarlet, and Voice of the Blood. She's writing a new wovel, a cyberpunk saga titled First World. As a guide to writing a novel in a serial fashion, she's looking to the past, not the future.
The example of Dickens is a really interesting one. I do have a larger story arc in mind, but it's not as tightly structured as it has been for the print novels that I've written in the past.
Publishing a wovel draws on skills used more often for journalism than fiction. Proofreader Rachel Miller uses tools entirely outside the realm of web work to ensure that the wovel is internally consistent.
I find myself holding up a ruler to the monitor, underlining, you know, going line by line, just, you know, looking at my style sheets or looking back at past stories to make sure that there are, you know, consistencies between characters and plot threads.
I just don't have any time. You know, I get up really early and I have three children, so I'm kind of pressed for time.
Amber Ney reads the wovel at home, late at night, and even sometimes at work.
Sometimes, yeah, if I'm in between projects or doing whatever and I happen to check my email and it would say that the new installment was up, I would click over and read it while I was at work.
By updating the serial format used by Dickens, publisher Victoria Blake is trying to bring an industry born in the 15th century into the 21st century.
It combines the technical functionality of Web 2.0, the creativity of fiction, and the pace of print journalism.
Blake says as reading habits change, the publishing industry has to continually figure out how to keep up. For NPR News, I'm Rick Kleffel.
The Obama family has officially moved to Washington, D.C. now, and the transition team has released a photograph of an intimate Obama family moment, a moment that happened this morning. The president-elect and his wife, Michelle, are sending their daughters off for their first day of school in Washington. The pictures were taken by photographer Callie Schell of Time magazine, and afterwards, she described the scene to us.
Yeah, he was just trying to make them laugh. I mean, he, you know, he's saying, you're going to a new school, you're both really bright, don't worry about getting everything right. Don't be afraid to answer the questions. And he goes, you guys are great. So just be you.
Callie Schell is one of a handful of photographers who has had personal access to the Obama family. She's been covering Mr. Obama for Time magazine since 2006. Her photos are now featured in a new book, President Obama, The Path to the White House. I asked her to look back to the days when she started taking pictures of the future president.
Well, actually, the beginning of 2006, I was covering them on the Hill. And then I went out on the road. He was helping state politicians campaign. And so it was the president-elect, a driver, and myself.
Just the three of you?
Just the three of us.
Wow.
So there's a photograph where he's at a truck stop or a rest stop, and he went in and he came back out, and this couple pulled up, and they're from Illinois, and they're, you know, Senator, Senator. And I love this picture because he's just reaching into the car, and behind it you see the fields and you see a truck. And it means more if you do the whole campaign, because that photograph and that life doesn't exist
anymore.
And
that moment's gone.
He's not gonna, I mean, he made a cell phone call on the side of the road, and then he talked to this couple, and there's nobody around. There are no agents. There's no press. There's no motorcade. Just him.
Now, I've got the book with me. And we've seen many of your pictures.
Time will be so excited.
Over Time, in Time magazine. And just quickly, I'd love to take us inside the scene, if you could. There's one picture that was taken in June of 2008. And Barack Obama is on an elevator, and he's surrounded by members of his inner circle. And what's interesting in this picture is the contrast between his expression and all the people who are around him. You see Michelle Obama, and you see Eric Whitaker, and you see Penny Pritzker, and you see Valerie Jarrett. They all have this look of expectation on their face. And he looks like he's in an altogether different place. What's the message there?
Well, this was the night he had clinched the nomination. And, you know, my editors were all going, oh, you know, and everybody's looking for this high-five picture, and he's not really a high-five person. I knew there was not going to be this emotional moment, because I knew that he's a person who, until the very day of the election, never let his guard down. So I actually have to admit, I was looking for a picture where he just looked at peace. And I love freight elevators, because nobody can go anywhere.
I was going to ask you how big this elevator was, because there
big.
Are a lot of people on that
yeah, there
elevator.
Are. I love freight elevators. Once you get on an elevator, you can't go anywhere. And we got on the elevator, and I knew I had, and he just crossed his arms, and it wasn't like, hey, it was just the satisfaction, we got to this point. We've made it.
Callie, I appreciate that you took time to come in and talk to us, because you're not actually on book tour. You're still working. In fact, this morning, you were on the job at the hotel with the soon-to-be first family as they were getting ready to send their kids off to school.
Yes.
A big move for this family. How did the girls do this morning?
They're amazing. You know, Sasha's the light and funny one who runs around and, you know, has seven and has all the energy. And Malia is just the most graceful young lady you'd meet. And they're both, I've found this whole campaign very wonderful. When they're with their parents, you can tell how excited they are to be with them. But today was their first day at a new school. And they were more worried about keeping their dad's spirits up, because he didn't get to go to school with them this morning. He had to go to Capitol Hill, and he wasn't going to get to go for the first day. And they were like, well, tell you all about it, Dad. And the thing that's is funny, it's probably been the whole campaign, because he and I talked about this, how hard it is to be away from your kids. The kids are half the time fine. It's you that's bad. So I think for him, I think he knows how lucky he is to have these kids that are so supportive of what he does and what his wife does. And he knows that he could not do this if it wasn't for his wife and his kids. And he never forgets that. And it's so obvious. You can tell by the way he looks at Michelle that it's not just his wife, it's his partner, and that one can't do without the other.
Callie Schell is a photographer for Time magazine. She's been covering Barack Obama since 2006, and her photos are featured in a new book called President Obama, The Path to the White House. Callie, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Michelle.
And you can see a slideshow with several of the photos Callie Schell has taken of Barack Obama since 2006 on the campaign trail and with his family. You'll find that at npr.org.
If the Obamas have time to do any sightseeing, they could drop by a place that has been described as the most beautiful building in Washington's Federal Triangle. There are more than 50 murals on the walls. It's not the National Gallery of Art, or any of the art museums for that matter.
Welcome to the Department of Justice. We're delighted to have you here.
This is one of the Justice Department's most famous tour guides. Winifred Hart has been retired for a while now, but back in 1996, the Justice Department recorded her giving this guided tour.
I don't like to talk about the people next door, but they have perfectly hideous walls and not very nice ceilings.
As Winifred Hart put it, the Justice Department is loaded with symbolism.
We drip symbolism in this building. This building is a sermon a hymn to justice.
If that sermon, if the hymn were purely predictable, it wouldn't be much worth talking about. Of course, the building has flags, eagles, scales of justice, everything you would expect. But there's also real art, dynamic paintings that were progressive, controversial, even radical in their time. For example, in the 1930s, the Justice Department installed a mural that showed black and white students being educated together. The art showed a dream that democracy had not yet realized. Washington, D.C. was still a segregated city. Virginia Mecklenburg is a curator from the Smithsonian American Art Museum.
The whole scheme of all the murals in the Justice Department was really a grand epic view of the role of law in American society.
The building was brand new. America was struggling through the Great Depression, and the country's most prestigious artists of the day competed to win commissions for paintings that would show how law and justice can make life better for everyone.
So these were going to be the shining stars that launched this program that they were hoping would put murals in post offices and federal buildings all over the country. It was a real initiative to take art to the American people, and not just people who were used to looking at art. It was a way to get art into the heartland of America.
One of the most arresting paintings in the building has a place of honor in the Justice Department. It hangs just above the main library, around the corner from the office where the Attorney General works every day. It's an anti-lynching mural.
There is a cowering or terrified person on the steps of the courthouse, with the judge coming forward from the court, standing off a lynch mob in bandanas with a flame of hate rising behind them.
Roger Kennedy is director emeritus of the National Museum of American History, and he used to be the director of the National Park Service. He's writing a book called When Art Worked, and he was an attorney at the Justice Department in the 1950s.
When we worked here, we would show up here to go get our briefs together. We thought we were serving the cause of justice. And this thing said to us, it's not foolish or proud or vainglorious to think that you're participating in the noble work of American justice. This is what you're here for. Go to work. Do it better.
So every attorney at the Department of Justice going into the library to research a legal brief will walk under this image.
Yeah. Yeah, and you hope that it takes.
It really is striking. One would expect in a building like this to see images of America at its finest. We walk into the Department of Justice, and in the main library, there is an image of what might be considered America at near its worst.
Yes, absolutely. This is art really doing its work, and it tells us what our country is really like. And incidentally, it's inescapably us, not somebody else, not the founders, not the 19th century, because there, what illuminates the scene are two things: the flame of hate in the back and the car headlights in the front.
And it is only the judge that is holding that back from the man cowering on the steps.
That's right.
One man in the lynch mob wears a dapper linen suit and a hat. In the back of the mob, two girls are waving. They look like they're having a good time. The man holding the lynching rope has his face covered. So does the man cowering on the steps. It's as if both the hunter and the hunted could be anyone. When John Stuart Curry painted this mural in the 1930s, lynching was a serious problem in America. Curry submitted one sketch after another to the Fine Arts Commission, and the commission kept rejecting the sketches and sending them back, before finally settling on the design that now hangs over the library. Curator Virginia Mecklenburg.
There's this wonderful letter, very nice letter, but a very firm letter from a man named Edward Rowan, who was essentially running the program at this, the mural program at this point, saying, you know, you're a terrific painter, and we really like the ideas that you've talked about, but we can't accept these murals because we don't think they are your best work.
Tough words for one of America's top artists. Mecklenburg says there was just so much riding on these murals. They were meant to launch a program that would inspire America and give the country hope.
The Depression was awful. There were bread lines everywhere. And somehow to suggest that we really are a civilized society, and in the case of the Justice Department, murals, everything having to do with law, that we can't slip back, that it would be terrifying if we lost, even in this dreadful time, we lost everything that we had achieved as we'd gone through the 18th, 19th, and 20th century to build the institutions that guide our lives.
Now a new attorney general is about to go through confirmation hearings. Eric Holder is set to become the first black attorney general in American history. When he walks through the halls of the Justice Department, he will pass all these murals, reminding him that this is his story and ours, and that his job is justice. The Justice Department is not open to the public, so you can't see these murals in person, but we have detailed images of them at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We are just wrapping up the season when many people on the West Coast crack open a crab. Dungeness crabs show up in markets and restaurants during the holidays. Fresh crabs are only easy to find for a few weeks. And during this time, the crabs provide a burst of flavor at the table as well as a burst of income for fishermen. They also account for a thriving fishery that is suffering from its own success. Here's NPR's Richard Harris.
It's 3:40 a.m., and I am at the harbor in Crescent City, California. Folks here are preparing their crab boats to go out for what promises to be an insanely long day of pulling crabs out of the Pacific Ocean. Already quite a number of the slips are empty, and the boats are idling and getting ready to head out to sea on what is thankfully a very calm-looking day.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Crab fisherman Brett Fawning has invited me to spend the day with him and his crew on the Rogue, his 58-foot-long fishing boat.
I bought this crab boat in 2004.
Fawning is a baby-faced 35 and sports a goatee. Under the boat's blazing lights, he pilots the Rogue out of the harbor at 4 a.m. sharp and heads out to sea. This port is a mere shadow of what it was decades ago. Two-thirds of California's commercial fishermen have abandoned their business in the last 15 years. But Dungeness crab is one bright success story. The rules for keeping this fishery healthy are simple. Fishermen only catch large male crabs, and only in a defined season.
It's just like a no-brainer sustainable fishery. It always has been, and it's not like they haven't changed anything from how it started.
Natural cycles do make the crab populations boom and bust. But biologists say fishing is no threat to the crabs. That's true even though there's an absolute frenzy when the season first opens.
It's kind of a derby fishery. Most of the production, and I don't know the stats offhand, but I'm educated guess is that 80% of the crab are caught in the first 2 weeks.
There are only so many crabs, and they get scooped up fast during the bonanza days. After that, it's slim pickings, so there's a race to grab them before they're gone. And more fishermen are joining the derby every year, meaning less crab per vessel. Boats that once caught other species are now turning to Dungeness crabs. That includes vessels that used to go out for salmon until that fishery collapsed a few years ago.
Since we haven't had that, more guys are kind of focusing on Dungeness crab and investing in Dungeness crab, meaning they're buying more pots, more gear, upgrading their boats.
It's become an arms race to catch crab. And as a result, economist Steve Hackett at nearby Humboldt State University says there's a huge overinvestment in the crab fishery. There are something like 170,000 crab pots off California, about three times as many as you'd need to catch all the crabs in a season. Those excesses also make crabbing less profitable. And the race for crab is dangerous. It's the deadliest fishery on the West Coast, with fatalities just about every year. Fawning says some fishermen are just too anxious to get in on the early days of the race, weather be damned.
I mean, I know what kind of boat I have here. It's an old wood boat. I'm obviously not going to go and fish in conditions that I shouldn't be fishing in. And you just have to use your head and be safe. And a lot of times guys don't do that.
Captains also fall asleep at the end of their long, long days and run up into the rocks. So safety and money issues have led crab fishermen to establish a task force to find ways to make their business more rational. A rational season would also mean more fresh crab. Right now, with the huge burst at the beginning of the season, most sweet Dungeness gets frozen.
Okay, I better pay attention here.
Brett Fawning slows his boat as he arrives at his first string of crab pots. He has about 450 in the water. They need to start pulling them well before dawn if they have any hope of harvesting all their crabs today. Standing on deck behind the wheelhouse, Bobby Kissinger uses a winch to pull up a crab pod. It takes just a few seconds to bring the cage up through 120 feet of water. The crew scoops out a couple of writhing crabs, brown, glistening, about 2 pounds apiece. They toss them into a bin, rebait the trap, and toss it overboard.
You can do that 400 times today?
400 plus, yeah. We get in the zone and we stay there for 12 to 18 hours.
As soon as one pot is done, the boat is up to the next one. Kissinger and his deckmate Andy Allen have their timing down to the second. Allen says most important is Bobby's control over the winch, which keeps the 100-pound crab pods from flying out of control.
Everything's right in that hand. If his hand slips, he makes the wrong move, and we're dead men.
Pot after pot comes on board. 5 crabs in one, a dozen in another. Nothing but giant starfish in some. Brett Fawning watches the action from the wheelhouse. He's a transplant from Wisconsin, educated as an oceanographer, but hooked on the business and sport of fishing. As each crab pot comes up, he eyes it eagerly to gauge his luck.
Pretty inconsistent, huh? It's all right, though, huh?
So how's this year panning out?
I think it's going to pan out okay. It's not going to be a disaster.
This is a slow year for crabs, but Fawning thinks he can earn enough, at least, to pay his bills. Fishermen could potentially make life easier for the entire crab industry if they could find ways to slow their expensive and dangerous arms race.
There's been suggestions of let's make it a daylight fishery only. No lights are allowed. You can only go fishing during the day. With the idea that's going to slow things down. Or limit the amount of pots is another one. But I don't think it's fair to try and equalize, to socialize the industry.
Sure, he says the situation now isn't ideal, but he likes the risks and rewards of the crab business.
I think it's the independence, really. It'd be pretty hard for me to go back and get a real job after this. I think it's really that. I mean, in the ocean, you know, there's the romantic part of it too, but I think it's just mostly the independence. The romanticism kind of wears off a little bit after a while, after you've been doing it for a while.
And it's that independent streak, found in so many fishermen, that will make it tough for the crab industry to agree on any changes. But they'll try. Finally, around 7:30 in the evening, the Rogue ties up again in Crescent City, with 4,000 pounds of crab in its hold. The crew members go their separate ways, but they will be back in about 8 hours and racing out again to their pots. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Richard continues tomorrow with new California fishing rules that are intended to protect both fish and those who catch them. I'm looking now at photos taken on board a crab trawler and inside a California crab shack. You can find them in an audio slideshow at npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. It's time for our weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered. Last week, we talked gaming and took you to a bar where the band plugs into an Xbox. This week, we watch a little TV on the computer. And since we're talking tech, I need to check in with our tech guru, Omar Gayaga. Omar, Happy New Year.
Hi, Michelle. Happy New Year to you.
So we're talking about TV on the computer. This is not exactly a new idea. My colleague, Robert Siegel, reported on it in the summer of 2007, quite a while ago. But a lot has changed since then.
Right. Well, you know, I'm a big TV junkie. Full disclosure, when I'm not talking to you or writing for the Austin American Statesman, I actually also write for the website Television Without Pity, which is owned by NBC. It seems like kind of like with the music industry, there's been this push and pull between TV networks and the web. Whenever certain videos would pop up on YouTube, they'd file an injunction or try to get it off the web. More recently, they've really come to embrace the internet and gotten a lot more content online where people can view shows whenever they want to.
It seems that they're actually pushing people online. I mean, I remember during the presidential race, it seemed that the clips of Tina Fey doing her Sarah Palin impersonation were everywhere.
Right. You used to have to really hunt to find clips from SNL. Now you can usually find them within hours of the broadcast or the next morning on YouTube, on Hulu.com, a lot of other places. Hulu was actually founded by NBC Universal and News Corp, but you won't find a lot of corporate logos there. There's no NBC Peacock or Fox spotlights. Even on other sites like Juiced, you see a lot of shows and a lot of archival stuff from all different places. It doesn't feel branded like that particular network. On Juiced, you could find Comedy Central's The Colbert Report or Showtime's The L Word. And it's not just new shows. There's an entire online channel devoted just to retro TV.
My weakness now.
Were we just hearing Betty Boop?
Boop, boopity-doo. Yeah.
So a few quick questions. This is all free, and is it all legal?
It is on these official sites. For instance, on Hulu, if you're watching a 45-minute TV show, you're going to get commercials every 15 minutes, like you would on TV. You can't skip them. You have to kind of sit and watch them, or you could maybe browse in another window while it's playing. But then on services like iTunes, where you're actually paying for the content, the commercials are gone. You're actually paying for the privilege of not having to sit through those commercials.
Now, if you're someone who watches a lot of television, enjoys watching television, prefers to watch television on television, does the technology on the computer match what you can now see on these, you know, these super large TVs that have plasma and LED and all kinds of special features?
Well, no, you're not going to get the same resolution. And there's this whole convergence issue right now of how are we going to watch all this stuff on our TVs? The electronics company LG just announced they're introducing a television with Netflix streaming built into it. But the thing about online is there's a lot of content that you just can't see on TV. You're not going to see it on your cable or satellite provider's list of channels. Fans of The Office and Battlestar Galactica have been able to watch special webisodes, as they're called, on the web. You can't see them on TV. They were produced specifically to be watched online. The web also opened the door for lots of entrepreneurs who are working outside of Hollywood, kind of using that same example of delivering straight to the people.
Well, Omar, we asked April Baer of Oregon Public Broadcasting to profile two of these people, and let's take a quick listen.
Rebecca Gerandese is ankle deep in mud, hunched low over her camera at the Ayers Creek Organic Farm. She's on a shoot for her internet-based show, Cooking Up a Story.
Anthony, tell me a little bit of what you've already done today.
Farmer Anthony Boutard is wrestling with burdock roots and explaining how he farms through wet Oregon winters.
You can't operate a machine in the wet soil because it'll just compact it and kill it.
This is not the kind of stuff Gerandese would have been able to do in her old job, shooting broadcast TV news. She put 20 years in as a camerawoman before switching gears. She now produces Cooking Up a Story almost single-handedly. The show's become sort of a foodie cult favorite with over 4 million online views. Some webisodes are cooking demos, others explore food policy or tell stories about sustainable food production. Gerandese hasn't looked back after leaving traditional broadcasting.
I remember I would try to pitch more of a feature-type story here or there, and it got turned down all the time. Now, on the internet, you can really go into a niche and stick with it.
Bringing the people behind our food to life.
I often explain FoodWorks as a youth empowerment program that uses food and farming.
Cooking Up a Story isn't making much money yet. But Gerandese says she's trying several different kinds of sponsorship, and the show has just been added by Hulu. When you watch Cooking Up a Story on different sites, you start to see how internet video is making use of the broadcast business model. On YouTube, you'll notice a tiny text ad at the bottom of the window. On Hulu, the show starts with a commercial that looks exactly like what you'd see on TV.
Regenerous Eye Dermapod from Olay. Love the skin you're in.
More internet ads mean more work for Paul Golden. He's a veteran animator and producer who's worked for TV, movies, and the web. Golden wasn't really sure internet video was taking off until last year.
It hasn't happened successfully everywhere, but I think it's starting to.
There was a time when no one was asking Paul Golden's company to make commercials for internet video, but they're asking now.
We don't have to create banner ads or very simple things in order for it to play on the web. Now it can just be the way you'd produce a high-end commercial for anything else.
Golden says there's one thing internet video and broadcast TV have in common. People don't want to pay to watch either. So the new media business model may not be so new after all. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
And we're back now with our tech expert, Omar Gayaga. Omar, April just said that the show that she profiled had 4 million online viewers. Is that considered a mega hit, or do other shows or webisodes have that large an audience?
It's considered a hit, but it's not unusual for just some weird viral video to get that many viewers on YouTube. Just something takes off, people start emailing it to each other, it gets featured on blogs, and really starts to take off. I think like the Saturday Night Live example, one of their big videos, which I'm not even sure I can say the name of on the air, got about that many within a couple of days of airing on SNL and then being put online, one of the Andy Samberg videos.
You know, there's a bit of irony here. Televisions are bigger and better than they've ever been, and now we're talking about going and watching this on computers instead.
Right, but I think the evolution is going to be that all of this content is going to end up on your TV. I think that's the future of television. They're all going to be internet-enabled. They're all going to be able to stream web content.
Omar, it is always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And if you all are curious about web video and you want to catch up on your Betty Boop, I'm going to post links to all of those sites and content that we talked about on the NPR website. That's npr.org/alltech.
Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman. We also want to encourage you, when you visit the All Tech Considered site, to register as a member. That way you can check in on the tech stories we're working on throughout the week, and you can chat with other NPR listeners about all of your tech questions. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Every day in Nashville, hundreds of musicians sign time cards and put in 9-hour days in recording studios for whoever's paying the bill. Just as surely as accounting or bricklaying, making commercial music is still work, hard work, which is why most pros spend some of their off hours playing with bands that remind them why they started playing music in the first place. Craig Havockhurst of member station WPLN has this profile of one such band, the Time Jumpers.
Thank you very much.
The Station Inn in Nashville might be the most famous bluegrass club in the world. Its neon beer signs illuminate vintage posters for shows by the likes of Ralph Stanley, the Osborne Brothers, and Mack Wiseman. But on Mondays for the past 10 years, the club has sounded more like Texas than Tennessee. If this were Texas, the floor would fill with two-steppers, but Nashville audiences are more inclined to close listening. So close that the front row could reach out and touch the lizard skin boots on fiddler Kenny Sears.
There's 11 of us on a stage that should accommodate 5 or 6.
Sears, a sideman for classic country artists such as Mel Tillis and Ray Price, says during his typical live gigs, he's on giant stages, far apart from his fellow musicians. The Time Jumpers, he says, draw their energy from intimacy.
Even when we play the Opry on a big stage, we bunch up together in the middle like a bluegrass band because it's just much more fun to play that way.
The Grand Ole Opry is where the Time Jumpers were born. Band members and Opry stars passed time between sets, playing Western swing tunes in Dressing Room 6. A tentative Monday night residency at the Station Inn took root, and a more formalized lineup started looking forward to the shows as the highlight of their week.
If you look at the way our business is now, this so-called country music business, we're about as anti-that as you can get.
Joe Spivey, a recording studio owner and a member of the three-man fiddle section, says the Time Jumpers draw a crowd that values the group's attentiveness to one another and to genuine musicianship.
That's one of the most joyful things about this band. Everybody is so conscientious. I mean, you'll notice when somebody's playing solos, everybody's doing whatever they can do to make that soloist sound as good as they can.
Those musicians are about as good as they come. Bass player Dennis Crouch just finished a tour with Alison Krauss and Robert Plant. Paul Franklin is the most recorded pedal steel guitarist working today. And seated in back, strumming a big archtop rhythm guitar, the way Freddie Green used to for Count Basie's orchestra, is none other than Ranger Doug Green, frontman of the Grammy-winning cowboy band Riders in the Sky.
this is my therapy, my relaxation. This is when I get together with the people I really like and play music I really love, and I don't have to front the band, and I don't have to remember jokes and make up the set list and drive 500 miles. I just get to show up and play with people I respect enormously, and it's just inspiring.
The lines between country music and jazz were blurry decades ago when Bob Wills and Spade Cooley built the Western swing sound around fiddles, guitars, and driving big band rhythm sections. In Nashville, such session pickers and producers as Hank Garland, Chet Atkins, and Owen Bradley were jazzmen when not making hillbilly records. So the Time Jumpers aren't out to break new ground. They're just an increasingly rare example of a band dedicated to group interpretation of classic American songs.
Now I don't buy sugar. You just need to touch my cup. You're my sugar. And it's oh so sweet when you stir it up. When I'm taking sips from your tasty lips, it seems the honey fairly drips. Your confection, goodness knows.
Right, that's Carolyn Martin. She says the Western swing repertoire and its focus on improvisation is something she appreciates from having grown up in Texas.
You have the freedom to go out on a limb just like the musicians do. And you know that they're going to be right behind you. Nobody's going to let you drop. It's heaven for a vocalist. It's a perfect situation.
Martin shares lead vocal duties with Dawn Sears, wife of Kenny, the fiddle player. Dawn discovered what's become her signature song when she was a recording artist in the 1990s. Her two record labels never would let her cut Sweet Memories by Mickey Newberry, but her performance of the ballad earned the band one of two Grammy nominations last year.
My world is like a river. The best rolls in, and it gathers all my sleep.
That recording proved bittersweet because it captured one of the last performances by the band's longtime steel guitarist John Huey. A veteran sideman for Conway Twitty, Vince Gill, and Loretta Lynn, Huey died just after the live CD and DVD was released. His protege, Paul Franklin, a veteran of hundreds of hit album recording sessions, stepped in.
They could have anybody in this band. I don't think there's a steel guitarist in town that wouldn't jump at this gig. So I was very honored, you know, that they asked me. And for me, it's such a step away from what I do on a day-to-day basis. Like today, I just did a project that was more like Matchbox 20, you know, than country. And then to come down here, it's just such a nice change of pace.
The station in audience doesn't hold back. They cajole the players and ring the bell by the bar for a particularly good performance. Some are old enough to have lived through the golden age of Western swing, but there are also college students who sing along with songs decades older than themselves. Celebrity musicians Robert Plant, Nora Jones, Jack White, and Bonnie Raitt have all gone out of their way to catch a Time Jumper show.
To me, the beauty of music is the unspoken communication.
Lead guitarist Andy Reese says the band's aim is not a retro experience or a revival of Western swing. Rather, they see the genre as an ideal vehicle for exploring a state of pure creative communion.
When your ears are wide open, your heart's wide open, you're not even really thinking, you're listening, you're part of something, and everybody is doing that. When that happens, it's pure magic. And as a musician yourself, you know how rare that is.
For these 11 musicians, at least it's no more rare than once a week. For NPR News, I'm Craig Havokhurst in Nashville.
And you can hear more music from the Time Jumpers at nprmusic.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.